Today, it's a great pleasure to have Maura Ramirez Quesada with us today. Maura is connecting from Europe, but she's currently based at University of Tokyo as a postdoc. And she got her PhD around the same time that I did, University of Durham in the UK. So this is supposed to be a joint seminar between Particle and Cosmo Group. I think it's interest to both sets of people. So she'll tell us about the radio sky and what it can reveal about electron-proton interactions. So whenever you're ready, Maura.
Yeah, thank you. So first of all, thank you for your kind invitation to give this seminar. This is actually a work that it has taken a lot of time to finish, and it's still not quite finished yet. We are still looking into some improvements for the results that we have so far. And yeah, you can find more details on this tag in this archive number. And well, this project was made with the help of Shyam Balaji, which is, he's also a postdoc, but he's in Paris right now, he's LPTHT. And my supervisor, PhD supervisor, Salim Boom. So I hope you enjoy the talk, and if you have any questions, just stop me or whatever. So this is the outline of the talk. So I'm gonna give a brief introduction, which is mostly motivation of the work what we have done. And then I'm gonna jump into the technicalities of the computation of what we propose here. And then I'm going to discuss the results and also point out the problems that we are facing right now and what we have to address in order to improve these results and make sure that what we are claiming is actually correct or not. And yeah, well, finally, there's just the summary of the talk. So let me start the introduction, motivation. Is okay. I'm wanting to discuss the electromagnetic background, which is basically the electromagnetic radiation from the Big Bang, and this has been measured with great precision from the lowest to the highest energies. With very, very good precision, and depending on at which region of the energy you look at which energy spectrum you are looking at, the origin of this background is going to be of different nature. For example, in this work, we are looking into the radio waves, the CRB, we call, which is the lowest tail of the spectrum. And these radio waves are essentially emitted by active galaxy nuclei, radio galaxies, and star-forming galaxies. And in general, this radio background is the sum of diffuse and discrete background emission, and some other cosmological background that can be redshifted into the radio window. So just above the CRB, the radio background, we have also the CMB here. And the measurements of the CMB has confirmed the existence of dark matter, dark energy, and also the idea of hot Big Bang and the inflation. And we know that the CMB has a almost a perfect black body spectrum. And it has been naively extended to the radio spectrum. So we have the CMB about 10 to the 18 hertz, and then it has been extended to the radio spectrum. And when they do that, the model, the CMB extension, it turns out that there's a discrepancy between what you expect to observe and the data that you actually observe. And this is mainly for some large foregrounds that you might have in the middle. And there have been many models trying to explain this with these large foregrounds contributions. And the most well-known is the PV96 foreground, which was proposed by these two guys, Rotero and German. And they have taken into account to construct this model contributions for normal galaxies and radio galaxies, and they look at the spectrum of 10 to the 3 to 10 to the 9 hertz. So in this work, the region that we are looking at is between 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 9. So here we have the extension of the CMB, and this is the data given by Gervasi in this work. So this is the data we are looking at. And this discrepancy, this PV96 model cannot fully explain these kind of discrepancies. Once we add the model to the CMB and we sum them up, it turns out that there's still some tension between the complete model and these observations of the radio background. So there has been some works that include new physics in order to explain these differences between model and observations. And basically they include dark matter, primordial black holes, and also cosmic strings. So the question that we asked ourselves at some point during this work was, because the world was, we were not meant to explain this kind of things per se, but once we realize where our results fall into this region, the question we asked ourselves was if this discrepancy between the model and the observation data comes from fundamental process rather than physics beyond standard model. So that was the question that we asked ourselves at some point during the process of working on this.
Can I ask you something, but just very quickly before you go on? So what's the tension between this PV96 model and the measured intensity? Is it one order of magnitude, factor of few?
I will show that later on.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah, so I will show a plot of the rates between the results of including only PV96 and CME. Great. Yeah, so I will show that. That was the question, right? So, and what happened is that we might have this additional radio source of a primordial origin that can explain this tension, that can conceal this difference between the observed radiation the observed data and the model. And basically we were looking at the recombination epoch where CMB photons decouple from matter. And the idea in this case is recombination doesn't happen. I mean, it's not an instantaneous process. It's not like from one day to another, so it takes time. So during this recombination process, we expect that the free protons and electrons interact and produce low energy photons through this process here, the Bremsstrahlung process. And the assumption in this work is that this new population of photons are different from the CMB, and they are not part of the thermal bath, and that the energy, we found out that the energy corresponds to the radial range. So that's the base, like the most general idea of the work when we were discussing this. So that was what we were trying to attack when we do this work. And obviously this additional population can be also absorbed by the inverse process, which will be just like an inverse Bremsstrahlung. So once you have this new population of photons, they can also, I mean, during the period they are propagating to the universe, they can also be absorbed by the same kind of process. So the what we were asking ourselves at some point was if some of them can survive this absorption. So if we might be able to obtain a net population of photons that we can observe at some point. So if this is if they survive, if we have that these photons survive this absorption, then we can try and feed the radio discrepancy between the theory and the field and the models that we have for CMB and this PV96 model. But after once you ask this question of if these photons survive the absorption, you also have to ask yourself if they thermalize or not. Because as I said before, you are assuming that these photons are created with a different energy than the CMB, but they can also at some point can be thermalized and go and the distribution function, the distribution function that we find by computing the emission and absorption rates of this new population can just become CMB photons. And that's a very important question that it's actually the question we have to address now, because if they do thermalize, then there will be no signal. And I will explain a little bit more at the end of the talk why. But if they do not thermalize, it turns out that they do not thermalize, then we might be able to observe this kind of signal. So this is the critical situation that the work suffers at the moment. So we need to understand and figure out if this happens or not. So now, despite that, something that I want to emphasize as well, like despite the case of PB96 and CMB and data and all these things that I mentioned, well, we have that this contribution comes from the Bremsstrahlung emission, which is associated to the electron-proton elastic scattering. And we know that theoretically, this emission of very low energy photons can diverge because the proportion is one over the energy of the photon. So the lowest energy the photon has, the emission will be really, really large. So theoretically, we have these infrared divergences, right? But these infrared divergences are canceled out by the reverse process. As I said before, they can also be absorbed. And this is it's a remarkable window into QED at low energy for the photons. So this contribution from fundamental particles and interactions represents the lowest test from the early universe. So despite everything I mentioned before, this is also very important in this sense. So now I'm gonna jump into the technicalities of the calculation to explain briefly briefly in the sense, very roughly what we have done, because actually for this, it took us a lot of time to figure out, and I will tell you why in a bit. But before, I want to make some comments about the assumptions that we made and the things that we found out. For example, in the free-free emission for electron-electron and proton-proton channels, you can also have these contributions, but these are suppressed. And this is basically because the accelerations of the two particles are equal in magnitude, but opposite in sign. And then you can have, because of the net radiated electric field, it's to be negligible. And also, in the channel of EP, like electron-proton scattering, we only assume that the photon is emitted by the electron, by the fermionic line. And this is because, in principle, you can also consider the emission from the proton, but this is suppressed by this quantity here. So we can also neglect that contribution. So we only perform the emission rate by this process when the photon is emitted by the electron. And since we are looking at the low energy limit, the proton behaves as a point-like object. So we are not considering the inner structure of the proton. And finally, we consider also the soft limit respect to the electron mass. So we have this limit in our calculations. So now, to calculate, we compute the Bremsstrahlung emission from this process here, and this is the general definition of the emission rate, where the different components are, first we have the particle phase space factors of the particles involved in the process. We have the square amplitude for Bremsstrahlung emission, and also we have the distribution function of the particles, which we consider to be Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. And this is just the number density of the particles involved in the process, the mass, the temperature of the plasma, and the momentum of each particle. In the low energy limit, we took this, we ignore basically the Pauli blocking, and we took the energy of the particles to be just the masses. And since the photons are very small compared to the particles that are in the plasma, electron and proton, we are safe to neglect the distribution function of the photons. And here I have basically when we compute this rate, we integrate over electron proton phase space factors, but not on the photon phase space. And it will be more clear why later. And well, I have, this is a very standard slide, but here the only one thing that I want to say is we compute the Brems square amplitude, which is this one, and you can find this expression in any textbook. And where this just corresponds in this case to the electron proton scattering, and this corresponds to the Brems photon, the emitted photon in this process. And this was the most difficult part of the work because we didn't understand how to compute this phase space of 2 to 3, like of a process of 2 to 3. So we were trying to figure out how to compute it without taking any limit, for example, without taking a cutoff that might, because of these divergences that we have in the emission and in the absorption rate. So that was, this actually was the part of the project that took the longest to figure out, and to, we try so many things, we try to understand many things. And at the end, we managed to make this integral, and we had, we had made several steps. For example, first we defined this new momentum definition in the soft, for the soft limit, for the soft limit. And then we also, we make another change of variable to U and V and Y. And in this case, this is just the reduced mass of the in the process. And this one, Y is just the angle between the initial momentum and the final, initial three momentum and final three momentum. And these U and V are given in terms of the reduced mass and temperature. And again, in order to define this, these PI and PF, initial and final momentum, are related to P1, P2, P3, P4. So we had several changes of variables. And in this case, this angle is just respect to the particles in the center of momentum coordinates. So it was kind of tricky to figure out all this in order to compute the emission and absorption. First of all, the emission rate. And once we figure out that part, we managed to express the amplitude, the square amplitude in terms of these variables, and then perform the emission rate, which is this expression here, once we have made all the changes and everything. And here I have this X defined like this, where this, the definition of X is this one. And here's the energy of the photon at that redshift zero, so at the present time. And we have the X just at that different, yeah.
Understand. Are you using plane waves for protons and electrons, or are you using the Coulomb wave? Because you see, the perturbation theory works for slow particles as alpha over v, or rather pi alpha over v has to be much smaller than one. That's the expansion parameter, not alpha. So I was on the previous slide, I was wondering, what is your M0? Is it just Born amplitude?
This is just electron proton scattering. You mean this one?
So you calculated using plane waves or the Coulomb waves?
I don't remember that particular detail.
In other words, do you have like a Sommerfeld enhancement in the end or not?
I think we don't have it.
And why?
Yeah, but I'm not I don't remember about that detail because we were so focused on the rest, but I'm not sure if I'm able to answer that question at the moment. I don't.
Particle physics language, it means that you have to resum the exchanges of various photons because this M0 cannot be just a Born amplitude.
Yeah, but it's not the Born amplitude because we had some comments afterwards and they were using the Born amplitude, but in here, yeah, we are not using that, but yeah, it's a, yeah, I'm afraid I'm not able to answer, like, I don't want to lie, so I'm not sure, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm gonna, yeah, so I don't know, any other question? Yeah, okay. So we have this variable here, new one. And this one is just basically the multiplication of F1 and F2 after made all these changes of variables and the expression that we obtain after integration of P in this case. And this function is just related to the square amplitude. So in terms of UV and Y. And of course, we use this delta function to integrate over V. And this is important because when you compute the integrals of the rest of the parameters here, of the rest of the variables, you find out that this is obviously going to be different in the case of the absorption. And that's what it might give you a signal and a result different from zero. That's also something like we were discussing with a lot of people because some people were saying that the absorption and emission might be just the same and they just cancel out. But because of the phase space, it's actually different from zero. So the absorption rate was computed in a similar way. So we use the same change of variables. Same, actually the expression for the amplitude is the same. And now the difference comes in this, in the phase space again, as I say before, where now the integral is over U and you have this change of variable, you have this result in the, after you integrate over U. And of course, as I said before, this is just different from the emission. So this was the hard part one of the hardest parts of the computation, because then we had to solve, well, in principle, we have to solve coupled Boltzmann equations in order to follow the evolution of the energy of distribution of the electron, protons, and photons for both cases, emission and absorption. But the point of this work and the point that we actually need to check properly is that we assume that these photons, because they have different energy and very low energies, they do not thermalize. So it's just enough to compute the evolution of the photon distribution itself. And the differential number density of photons of this energy is related to the emission rate like this. And we also have the photons that are removed by the absorption term, which in this case are related. This word here is just the Jacobian after one relates the time, proper time to the redshift. So it's just very technical stuff. And in this case, in the case of the absorption, we have the definition, you see that there is a tilde here, is because in the case of the absorption, we also need to take, I mean, obviously we need to include the distribution function of the new population of photons into the absorption rate to see how many of them survive. And this is the definition that we have of this non-thermal distribution function, where this guy here is the net number of photon of energy E gamma. So this expression here would be the number density of the photons that survive the absorption. So what were we doing at the beginning, or at this stage, what we were doing was just fully compute this expression and obtain this kind of function, distribution function, and input in the absorption term and compare both plots and see if you have like a larger emission or a larger absorption. But that was not quite what we wanted to do. Like we wanted to see like the net result. So for that, as I say before, we had to put, like, in order to see the evolution of this number density of the new photons, we had to exchange, I mean, we have to relate the redshift to the proper time. And that's why we have this, we have written everything in terms of the redshift at the end. So the net number density of photons, the photons that you expect to observe, is a balance between what you emit, what is emitted and what is absorbed. So we were trying to figure out how to express that. And my collaborator, Sham, he was the one who proposed this equation, this ODE, where you have the number density of net photons, the ones that survive the absorption. And here you have the term that is for emission and the term that is for the absorption case. So in this case, as I said before, this is the definition of this distribution function. And you can see that it's also related to this quantity here. So in order to solve this equation, differential equation, we set this boundary condition where this set non-equilibrium, this redshift of non-equilibrium is just corresponds to the redshift at the point where these photons started to accumulate after they were emitted. So that means that before this redshift, you didn't have this signal, but at some point this signal became important and start to accumulate. And then at some point the emission start to be lower and lower and then fade the number density of the photons. So this for us was the second, after we figure out how to compute all the emission rates and the absorption rates, this was like the second harder thing that we had to figure out, because we were not quite understanding how to manage to express this kind of evolution. And that's when Sham figured out the way and proposed this solution for seeing the evolution of these photons, the new population of photons. And well, this function here just ensures that the absorption can never exceed the emission, because you cannot absorb more than what you have, right? So that was not a physical result. And by introducing this kind of differential equation, we ensure that the absorption will always be lower or equal than the emission. So you will never have a solution where the absorption wins. Of course, we introduce this term to take into account the universe is expanding, and then these photons get diluted as this universe expands. So now I want to just show the results, what we obtain. We solved the differential equation for different redshifts here, and we compute the number density of the total number density of photons that survive the absorption. And well, for very large, very early times, you see that there's a lot of, the number density of photons is quite large. And as the universe expands and as it cools down, then the number density of photons drops to 10 to the minus 5, the order of 10 to the minus 5. And this makes sense because at this epoch, then recombination is very efficient. Like there are less free electrons and protons. So there's the emission of this new population of photons, it's smaller than in around here, for example. And well, also we compute, this is a number density versus the redshift, but we also compute the differential number density respect to the frequency versus the frequency here. And this is the part where we realize that our signal at different redshifts was falling into the radio spectrum. And actually, when we started the project, we never thought on any applications per se. But when we realized about this, we started to look into the literature to see what else we can tell about this signal that we might obtain, we might have from this kind of process. So, yeah, it was kind of like a bit chaotic at the moment, trying to figure out what we could do. But yeah, in general, in this plot, we can see three different regions. So the first region is for 10 to the 10 hertz, above 10 to the 10 hertz. And in this region, the emission of these photons is very, like the rate emission is very low. So it goes to zero because the energy of the photon is very large, so it's suppressed. But then you have the second region, which is between 10 to the 10, 10 to the 8 hertz, where emission and absorption is large, but the absorption is large. Sorry, the emission is larger than the absorption. And that's the region where you get these peaks here. And the third region, which is below 10 to the 7 hertz, in this case, absorption wins. So in this case, both emission and absorption are very, very large and they diverge, but they also cancel out. And so that's why you see this behavior here in the plots. So these are the three regions.
Can I ask you if you say had a different coupling constant, if the electric charge were to be larger, for this emission, would your excess be larger or smaller?
I think if it would be larger because it's proportional to the coupling. Right. Yeah.
But on the other hand, one can say, well, the faster the process is, the better approach to the equilibrium is, and therefore the excess should disappear. So I would argue that if you get it,
actually.
Smaller, not larger. So what's up with that?
Yeah, I mean, actually this point is on something that we also have been discussing with other people. And if I understand well, I think I'm going to address that question at the end of the, yeah, because, yeah, I mean, all that I have to say is just regarding this work, but we also are aware that there are some issues that we need to address. And that's what I want to discuss a little bit at the end. But from the expressions that I had before, and the fact that this is proportional to the coupling, of the process, then if you have you have a coupling that is larger than that, then obviously this peak might be a little bit larger. But that also depends on how efficient is the absorption for that particular process.
Boltzmann equation, but okay. One suggestion would be the top plot, not to plot N gamma per se, because it's a changing variable, but a shape of the photon distribution as a function of X, which is the omega versus temperature, right? for different redshifts, right? So if I have I want to understand how far back this excess exists, right? Because so if I go to earlier and earlier and earlier times, do I have spectral distortions or not?
But yeah, I guess, I mean, here actually 3,500, 3,000 is too large. So we actually just chose this to see the difference of the peaks. But I think at some point we were arguing that going too far away, too back to the early times is actually not really something that you expect to see this kind of signal. But
then just, how would it disappear? That's the good question.
Your
approach, how would you reproduce the Planckian spectrum at the early times?
Yeah.
Stand to Planckian spectrum. These are the questions.
We agree with that kind of questions, and it's part of some of the issues that we need to figure out to fully understand and to actually being able to say that this signal might exist. So that's why, like, I always emphasize that it's a possibility, but we need to figure out things in order to be sure that it's actually what is going to happen. But I totally agree with that comment, with the questions that they need answer. Where I was? Oh yeah, well, regarding all these questions, and this is the last part, and I think this is the messy part, because when we realized, as I said before, when we realized that the signal that we were getting in, it was in the radio frequencies, we say, okay, this might be able to give us the contribution that we need in order to conciliate what we observe and the model what we expect because of the models. So that's why we apply this to foregrounds. Like, for example, here we apply this. In here I have the CMB model, and I also have Gervasi data plotted, the blue dot points, and this is the PV96 model. And in purple, we have the contribution from this process, which was found to be at 2150, the one that will conciliate and will give us more precise fit to the data. So for example, in here, what we have is that, I mean, this happens at this redshift, and in this, if we compute the redshift, then the number density of photons, this redshift is this number here, which is, it's not too big compared to the CMB, but it's also not tiny. No, it's quite large. So comparing this in the second plot, what I have is the data over the CMB plus PV96 only. So here, for example, I have that for the first dots, for the first data, we have we reduce from 43%, which is around here, to 8%. We conciliate a little bit at this frequency. For the second, we went from 36% to 1%, and 90% to 4%, and this is 11% to 2%. So we realized that it was quite good in terms of reducing the tension between the data and the models. So that's what we found out. But as I said before,
sorry, before you go on, are there any error bars in any of these?
There are in the data, but they are so tiny that you cannot see them. Okay. So we were not able to put it didn't make sense because they were just like very close.
Infinite very sigma discrepancy.
Yeah. So so this is the last part of the talk, where I want to emphasize that after putting this in archive and after many people discuss with us and we discuss with many people and we find out that we had to address other stuff, but the principal one and the one that we are targeting now at the moment, which is still in progress, is that when we talk about emission and absorption, but any process, we are respect to the CMB, right? So any deviation is respect to the CMB, and we need to take into account the Bremsstrom emission and absorption into the path of the CMB photons. Now, in that case, when we need to include in our equation, a differential equation, we need to include as a initial condition as well, the CMB photons and then solve that differential equation. But the problem that arises here is that when we compute the absorption rate for CMB photons using the same, just using the number density, the distribution function of the CMB photons, we find out that the absorption is larger than the emission, the Brems emission. And that is a problem because if happens that the new population, these new photons that we proposed in this work with a different energy, with different temperature than the CMB and lower temperatures get thermalized into the CMB photons and they become CMB photons, then obviously this signal will disappear. So what we need to answer right now, and we are working on it, but we've been like everyone has been just too busy to keep going with this. But the step that we are at the moment is we need to know if these photons thermalize. And if they do, then obviously we need to change the direction of this work. But if not, then that's good news because then it means that even though you include the CMB background and if these photons don't thermalize, then you will be able to observe this kind of signal. So I understand like the many people had like a lot of questions or things that we might need to consider and look at into the work. But I think for now, the one that it's more important is just to see if these photons eventually thermalize after they are produced or not. So that's the main question that we are trying to address right now. And it's a critical situation in the sense that this might be the case where, we need to change or we need to try to find another way to apply this result, which is already exciting without all the CMB and stuff. It's already exciting to see this kind of behavior into maybe, I don't know, some other kind of situation happening in the universe. So this is just a summary. So in general, we have computed emission and absorption of Brems Brems photons emitted in electron proton scattering process. We also, in the world, investigate the consequences of such calculation on the distribution of photons that could be injected and absorbed by electron proton scattering. So these Brems photons emitted by this free emission are not completely absorbed. We found out that they are not completely absorbed, but then the reverse process. And that for a very narrow range of photon energy and redshift, the emission could just win over the absorption, and then you will have these kind of peaks in the plots. And finally, we argue that this Brems emission associated with this electron proton scattering in the early universe could form part of could be a source of radio emission today. And the statement that we use when we compute this is that the non-thermal population of photons with energy lower than the CMB energy that survived this absorption, that the inverse process might never get thermalized. And if that is the case, then you will see that this new, this extra signal. But there's still work going on, and the most critical one is whether this new population do or do not thermalize with the CMB photons. So that's that's it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Maura. Yeah. And virtual applause. Do we have any questions? Or more questions, I should say?
I have a question. Did you try to compare with the textbooks? So if you go to Landau-Lifschitz volume 4, they calculate Bremsstrahlung and they take a non-relativistic limit and so on. And, you know, like as a first test, whether you're...
Yeah. Yeah, well, at the beginning, we actually were taking textbooks results because it was, I mean, this is a process that is already given, right? The problem, I mean, the cross-section and amplitudes are calculated, computed with cutoffs and some regularization. The problem when we try to compare is in textbooks, you have the cross-section for two limits, low energy and high energy. So you have two different expressions sometimes. Well, usually in the textbooks. And the problem here is that we, in this world, we have compute the emission and absorption rates, but what we need to do now is compute the cross section in order to compare and see the limit and see when, like, if we obtain similar results or we obtain the results at some limit. But as I said before, even computing the rate emission was very hard and it was very difficult to figure out. And before going to the rates emissions and absorptions, we first tried the cross sections, and that was even harder for us because without taking any limit. So that's something that
in the limit of non-relativistic electron, right? So you would expect the cross-section, differential cross-section to be d omega and then there will be like Sommerfeld factor and whatnot for the and then some sort of a Rutherford type scattering, right? So this is these are known things, no? It's on you to compare it properly, no?
Yeah, I think the easiest way to compare what we have, the expressions that we have, is from the textbooks, take the process, take the amplitude with these limits and compute the emission and absorption rates instead of vice versa. I don't know if I explain myself because we don't have cross sections. So we have emission, we have rates, we have emission and absorption rates. So in that sense, we cannot compare.
Cross sections and compare, yes.
Yeah, but it's not. I mean, trying to do it in the same way that we did it here is not so trivial. We have tried that. So we actually were discussing that maybe the easiest way to compare them is instead of computing the cross-section with our formalism, instead compute the emission and absorption rates using the results from textbooks. Because we've been trying to compute this cross section using all this formalism without making any cutoff. So that is the situation that we had at the moment. But yeah, I agree. We should compare. It would be nice to see the results from textbooks and our result.
Any other questions?
So I was just wondering, so can you show again the slide comparing, the observed spectrum, to the model calculation?
This one?
So I was just wondering, so what's preventing this PB96 just from having like some larger amplitude?
What do you, I don't understand. What do you mean?
Well, so if I just, you know, took your PB96 curve and then like you raise the amplitude a little bit, you know, would that fit better? On the top, right, so you have that PB96 curve, which is added to the CMB.
Oh, this one.
Yeah. I was just wondering, so what's stopping, you know, the PB96 model just from changing its amplitude a bit?
That I'm not sure. I guess it's because I'm not sure how to answer that question, but from what when we were reading about these models trying to fit this, it was because they already have taken into account all the possible foregrounds and there was no more to include in the model. But yeah, I mean, I'm not quite sure if that might be the right answer to your question, but in principle, I think that might be the reason why. So that's why when people look at into this kind of situation, they include new physics like dark matter or other kind of situations that might explain these differences.
Okay, thanks. Also, this plot, I guess, is showing like the monopole. Is that right? Do you know if there's any measurements of of the angular power spectrum of this XS?
No, but that would actually be pretty cool to do. Okay.
The radio XS, at least at this lower part of the frequency where it goes up and up and up, shows very little fluctuation on the sky, much less than what naively the compilation of radio galaxies would suggest. So it's a problem actually for the explanation of the radio excess.
Okay, so the angular power spectrum you're saying is like much smaller than you would expect from some galaxy power spectrum?
Yeah, Gil Holder has a paper on this from maybe 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay, interesting. All right, thanks.
Is that small angular anisotropy comparable with recombination expectations? Or there's some bound on the amplitude?
I mean, like this rise towards the lower frequencies, it's believed to be, it's, the spectral index is -2.6. It's believed to be some sort of synchrotron. So it's believed to be generated like late after z equals 10 or something like that. But
if we believe the premise here, you know, what Maura just told us, then if it's primordial, there is an expectation for.
How can it be primordial?
Well, that's the hypothesis here, right? The excess is coming from recombination. So you want to test it, measure the anisotropies, and you know what to expect. But is there a bound or a measurement? That's my question.
No, but even let's say I doubt the result of this thought, but even if I take it, right, it's going to be somewhat of a correction at the bottom of this, right, of the dashed curve, right? It's not going to be the excess explaining the whole excess, right? Because this PB96, it's got to be some sort of an astrophysics combination of best kind of mock idea of the radio galaxies being put together, right?
Okay. Hi, by the way, Maura. Nice to see you.
Hi. Nice to see you. Well, your name. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Nice to see you now. Cool office.
Okay. Do we have any other questions? I want to just end with a stupid question. What prevents me from drawing a uncertainty band on this PB96?
What do you mean?
I just want to know, is there a way to come up with some uncertainty for this? For your, because I know you said the uncertainty on the data is very small.
Yeah, it's very small.
On the prediction.
Yeah. Well, in the day on the prediction, I don't know what would prevent that. But it when you have prediction, you can have bends.
Yeah, I mean, maybe this is a particle
physics. You don't have a bend on CV, that's for a good reason.
Yeah.
But for the radio galaxies, yeah, you should have answer on this, yeah.
Probably there is a band, but I'm not sure. I might need to, if there is a band, maybe there's a way to constellate, but
maybe this is just a particle physicist trying to understand a astrophysics prediction, but okay. All right, so thanks again, Maura, for taking the time.
Thank you for the discussion, it's very appreciated.
Yeah.
Discuss about this.